everybody. Welcome back to the Lumieres podcast. We've made it to the autumn of 2020 and the leaves are starting to drift from the trees and change colour, and the cold is coming in, the rains are coming down, seasons are changing, and it's that time of year when things start to die. It's like a death and rebirth kind of time, I always think, in the autumn. We only need to look outside to see this reflected in the natural world. And I think it triggers something, whether we're aware of it or not, similar in the human psyche, as it were. A signal that summer is over and we're looking towards the winter, turning inwards. Oh, what a strange year it's been. Full of challenge and struggles, really. Small dramas. And speaking personally, I've just found it really difficult to orient myself around this situation and going through these phases of worry and anxiety back in the spring when it was all hitting, getting really obsessed with cleanliness and leaving our packages at the door. And I think at this point we're kind of less obsessed about the cleanliness thing and we understand a bit more about the virus and how our bodies will work with it and what we can do in terms of things like, you know, like vitamin D and C and iodine. And people are more aware that these things have a dramatic effect on whether the virus stays in the body. So it's been a few months since the last episode. Summer happened or didn't happen anywhere near in the normal way that summer does happen. Festivals were cancelled, social gatherings were cancelled, trips were cancelled. It's been very strange to kind of be in the same place without things to look forward to and travel to and events to go to. Only very minimally, there's been a few events here and there, but really, really minimal, and sort of compounded by breaking my toe, which took, they take six weeks to heal broken toes. Who knew that? And you can't do a lot while you've got a broken toe, especially when there's a crazy foster dog bouncing around the house needing your attention and your partner's having a flare-up of her chronic health conditions, and suddenly it's all you can do to get through the day and eat and cook and clean and make sure that everything is in order, really. It's kind of strange when you go without work for a long time. There are always things to be working on, projects, and I've been working on tweaking my book and starting to build a new website and all this kind of stuff. But there's been something in me which just wanted to embrace this pause. You know, it was an enforced pause, really, and a time for reflection. I felt very contemplative the last few months and not really wanting to do too much out in the world and put anything out publicly, and just sort of like let everything sink into me. And I've been meaning to record this intro for a while now, and it's just never felt like something I wanted to sit down and do. It's funny, like I don't understand people who do a weekly podcast and have to get them out every week. And it's like this pressure to do something new every week. And if you imagine how many podcasts there are doing weekly episodes, and I'm sure loads of them are fascinating and, you know, there's something for everybody, but who has that sort of time and inclination to go through and listen to, constantly listening to podcasts? I do not at all. And I'm kind of aware of the fact that we swim in a sea of content, really. And people are putting stuff out all the time, now more so because we're all stuck at home and we need things to occupy ourselves. But still, this will never be a regular weekly podcast. I mean, it even started off being monthly, and even that drifts, really. But I'm quite happy for it to drift. I think that's fine. It's my project, and I'll put one out as and when my inspiration strikes, you know. I've got people lined up for further ones, so there will be more coming, but they'll never be regular. They'll just be irregular, and I quite like that. So over the summer, I was thinking about doing some more of these, and a friend of mine mentioned that she knew a record producer whose name rang a bell with me, and his name's Chad Blake. When I was a kid, as a teenager, I used to buy CDs. That was the era, and I'd started to notice on the back of these CDs, it would say like mixed by, produced by, you know, it wasn't just the band. There was this kind of feeling and growing realization that to make a record takes a number of people. It takes different skills. It takes the engineer. It takes the mixer. It takes the mastering. engineer and all these kind of different things, the artist, the cover designer, there's so much to it other than the musicians. I mean, obviously they are the main part, but then to make it a record, it sort of goes through all these different processes. And so this name, Chad Blake, was on some of the CDs that I was listening to, and I always thought, wow, that's an interesting name. He spells Chad with a T, that stuck out. I always remembered it. And then I saw his name crop up over the years on different records, and it's Pearl Jam, a binaural record that he worked on, or at least part worked on, as you'll hear. And he steadily became basically one of the world's leading mix engineers. He's a producer and engineer as well, and known for his creative mixes. And he's worked on records by the Black Keys, Sheryl Crow, Suzanne Vega. He's won Grammys, Crowded House, Peter Gabriel, Tom Waits, Pretenders, all sorts of people from all over the musical landscape. Chad has mixed and sometimes recorded. And he's a lovely guy. He's very funny, very humble, and he was very willing to share his story about how he got into this crazy world. And I'm really grateful to him for his time and his candid attitude to interviews. So it turned out when my friend mentioned him, thanks Emanation, he lived about an hour north of me. So that felt easy enough to go up and do. And craving a face-to-face podcast, you know, I refuse to do Zoom podcasts. I always refuse to do podcasts which are not face-to-face. So he was up for it. We social distanced, we sat outside, and you can tell because there are parts of this episode where the wind noise is pretty crazy. We were sitting in the Welsh Hills and sometimes the wind comes through. So I did my best to do some editing, but there will be parts where it's a bit windy, for which I apologise. But yeah, Chad was very happy to share his story about his life in music, from his early days as an LA studio assistant to his long-term partnerships and different projects he's worked on and what he's working on now, to settling down in mid Wales with his wife Jackie and raising their two boys. And his son Stan had just received a guitar when I arrived in the post, and he was very excited. And the music that you hear just before our conversation for a few seconds is Stan just playing around with some blues. We started the conversation just talking about our experiences with cancer, and Chad recovered from an experience with cancer about 5 years ago, and he talks about it a bit briefly, and then we go into his life in music. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. It was really fun to chat with Chad, and it turns out we got a few things in common that we enjoy. And it was amazing to put a face to a name who I'd only seen on the back of these CD cases as a kid. And now here I was sitting in the wilds of Wales talking to this lovely gentleman in his back garden. And I'm really happy that I can bring this conversation out and share it with you guys. So thank you as ever for all your support. I really appreciate everyone who listens to this podcast, sends me messages. You know, you can always write to me if you feel like you want to. You can get me on jody@jodywhite.co.uk. You can find me on Instagram at Instagram/lifeinfractals. Chad is also on Instagram. Chad Blake is his handle. Quick shout out to my friend Bert, who started listening to the very first episode of the podcast back in the spring, summer, when he was building a shepherd's hut, and worked his way through every episode diligently, soundtracking his building. So thank you for that, sir. That's the kind of dedication that we are looking for in new listeners. A quick update on my book for anyone who's interested. It's kind of at a point where it's needing an editor. I'm hopefully going to work with an editor to do the final tweaks and proofs and things. And then I think we'll be going indie. We'll be going indie publishing, which is exciting, but also a bit scary. There's a lot of work involved, but thankfully I've got some skills that will help me out in that department. And there's a lovely community called the Association of Independent Authors, who are very supportive and helpful in these matters. I did start going down a traditional route, but I think with the year, the way it's gone, and the literary industry kind of struggling and having a lot of book postponements and things like that, I think the last thing that was going to happen was somebody just deciding to go and punt a chance on an unknown debut author. So I feel like it was interesting to send those things out and do the submissions process and get some nice replies and some kind words back. But I think it's going to be good to push myself to make it the very best I can and do it all myself with a few independent helpers. So that'll be coming at some point soon. There's a mailing list on my personal website, which is jodywhite.co.uk, J-O-D-Y-W-H-I-T-E. And if you want to hear from me at some point in the future about the latest developments with the books and things like that, there'll probably be a few sample chapters and things like that going out to people on the list. So do sign up there if you'd like to hear more from me. So with that said, I will waffle on no longer and we will go straight to the conversation with Chad. I do hope wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you are warm and safe and looking after yourselves and each other. It's going to be an interesting winter. Breathe deep and go well.
I just hit 5 years 2 months ago.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm good.
Do you still see anyone or do you not?
No, 5 years was it. That's my last... Yeah.
Good for you, man.
Yeah, man. So you too.
High five.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So you didn't feel like it kind of changed your outlook or changed the way you kind of thought about stuff. You were just like, hey, that was a shit time, but I'm through it.
Well, I don't know what there would be to change it. Do you know, I'm really lucky that with all the stuff I've done and been through, I mean, I've been through a fair amount with people dying, people close to me dying, and going through some hardships that way, you know, without much experience beforehand. And, you know, I'm a little bit of a loner.
Yeah.
So I don't have huge support groups. I mean, I've got friends, but it's not, I don't really go out of my way to see people all that much. You know?
Yeah.
As much as I like people that I know, you know, yeah. We do get together and, but I'm much more comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's just me, yeah. You know, and yeah. I always have been.
Yeah.
I've come out of my shell a lot since my 20s and 30s,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I was always, you know, weekends were not partying and, you know, going out with the lads to a bar. It was me getting in a truck and driving out to the desert with a box of cans of beans and sitting around a fire, you know, with a cold can of beans and dropping acid, you know?
Like, I was waiting for the last bit there. I was like, are you just staring into the beans or what's going on?
Yeah, no, just, and then go for walks out in the desert and climbs out in Death Valley. And
where did you grow up, Texas?
We moved from Texas, went to California, spent most of my life in California, back in Texas for my sort of late adolescence and early teen.
Yeah.
I went to school, Friendswood, Texas, which is just outside of, most part of Houston now.
Okay.
But it was out in the country when I was there. There were buffalo there when I was there.
Whoa.
Yeah. Wow. There was not a herd, but, you know, like 8 buffalo in the field next to ours, you know, and there's nothing around. Really nice. It was a very cool town.
Yeah.
And my relatives down there I really love. And I had a second family, the McDonald's, down there. And then back to L.A. And junior high and high school in Los Angeles.
Where did love for music start then, do you think, when you... When you were going out in the desert, were you playing stuff?
You know, when I was, I don't know, 10, 11, there was my best friend's dad was a stagehand on some show in Los Hollywood. Maybe it was nine, it was before we went back to Texas. And for his kids, he had twins and another kid, and they were always singing and playing guitar, so we ended up getting guitars and forming a little group. We did stuff like They Call the Wind Mariah and House of the Rising Sun or something, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all I knew. And then I didn't start my guitar playing again until it must have been about 17, 16 or 17, my last, middle or last year of high school. I was late in high school. My sister started going out with a guy named Rick Zinniger and Christy. And he was unbelievable. I mean, still one of the best guitar players I've ever seen. Wow. And he went on to do quite well. But he went into jazz. He got out of the rock scene.
Okay.
And of course, at that time, this is 60s, late 60s, drugs were everywhere. And I couldn't smoke pot. I couldn't, there's nothing I liked. I didn't like to drink. I didn't like, but somebody gave me a quarter hit of acid and I took it and it was my drug. It fit like a glove.
Yeah.
Really, really did. I never had a bad time.
That was the time for it as well, right? Yeah.
Like, never had a bad time on it. And mushrooms soon came after that and some peyote.
You ever try? Yeah, I was going to say, do you ever try mescaline?
Yeah, yeah. And all that, all any kind of hallucinogen was good for me. And I got into microdosing in those days.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, way ahead of the curve.
Well, you know, it was expensive. It actually wasn't, but it was to me. But no, I used to cut things up into eighths and sixteenths and just...
Wow.
And then go to school. And,
was anyone else doing that?
Yeah, we had a couple. I had a couple of friends. We, you know, just to get a little...
Because people talk about it now like it's like the best thing since, you know, the people writing books about it.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's become a thing.
It's like, yeah. But I'm sure I would have thought surely people were doing that back in the day, but...
Sure.
You don't hear about it.
No, sure. I mean, you know, Liberty Caps, people have taken, you know, you just take one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Take a Liberty Cap and it just sort of gives you a nice fuzzy feeling.
Like,
So
did that dovetail with creativity?
Well, it did. I think at that time, in those days, the acid had speed in it, a bit of speed, which I didn't mind. I was okay with it. And, you know, you'd be up all night. And I started playing electric guitar.
Ah.
And I'd just play with records. And I got Rick Zinniger, he would bring records over. And I remember he brought the first King Crimson record over.
Fantastic.
And I saw the cover and I went, oh my God. and he brought Band of Gypsies, the Fillmore West, or was it the East Show? No, the... Whatever the famous Band of Gypsies record was that had Machine Gun on it, that's the classic Machine Gun. And I remember hearing that for the first time and just, I could not believe, like,
people playing
three
like that.
People were doing that.
Yeah.
And this guy was creating a war scene on stage with his guitar and there was nothing else. And wow. it was musical, melodic.
Yeah.
It was noise, it was violent, it was beautiful. I mean, I just couldn't believe it.
Mm.
And I was hooked. And so Hendrix, of course, it's like in my chromosomes, it's like, I hear Hendrix and there's nothing, almost nothing in music that can, my bias is towards those moments that I heard the first Hendrix. I was getting these records, Electric Ladyland. I ended up getting that, a year later or something. And
God, it must have blown minds.
Yeah, yeah, it was amazing. This is after it all came out. I was getting into it late, really. But that really did get me into playing, and I went so far with my playing, and I was in some bands and. Got some kudos around L.A., playing in clubs and performing.
Did you like playing live?
I did. I used to jump on the tables and down and do a thing. And but as the bands were getting more complicated and more complicated songs, I was falling behind because I didn't like to actually practice and learn music. I just learned stuff off of records.
Yeah.
And I didn't train my ear. I mean, I can learn just listening to a record. But I have to sit down with it. Stan can hear something once.
Some people have that, right?
And, you know, yeah. 8 hours later, he'll come down and go, oh, what was that song I heard? Oh, yeah, here it is.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, okay. So, yeah, I fell behind. And also, it was getting to be a time in the mid-70s where I went on the road a few times and ended up hating it, not liking the gigs, and getting put off by playing. And that's not something we hear around here very often.
Just let him go over.
And
but you still had the love for music. It's just that you didn't really want to do the gig life.
Yeah, yeah. I guess what happened? Yeah, I stopped playing music. I thought, oh, maybe I'll learn music. I went to Las Vegas, believe it or not, because I had friends who were in the music business there and taught music, and I started working in a camera store as a salesman.
Ah, okay.
And got into cameras and photography. And that led me somehow over the years. And then I ended up back in L.A. Somebody asked me to play guitar on a demo of theirs. Nobody that anybody knew. And I got in there and talked to the engineer. And he had said, if you like music, but you don't really want to play anymore, this is a great job, being an engineer. And then I had another friend, Brett Webster. He was a sound guy. He used to go on adventures with his dad, who was a director, and they'd look for Yeti in the Himalayas, you know. And he would work he had an Agra that he would take and do the sound for his dad's.
Wow.
And I did a show with him. I did a thing on sharks. We went looking for great white sharks off the Pacific coast.
Yeah.
And I was hired as photographer and boom boy.
Ah, okay.
And that's where I really got it. And Brett was pretty instrumental. He gave me his Audio Engineering Society pass 1 year to go to the big convention in L.A. And I went, and it was amazing.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, oh, this
that was the light bulb moment. It was like,
yeah. So then I started going. I was living in Hollywood. I just started knocking on doors, and you know, 3 times a week I'd go to the studio, knock on the door, and it ended up after a while they were all laughing, going, "Oh, it's Chad. Any work today? You got even? No, there's no work. There ain't gonna be any work. There's like, you know, come on." I said, "Oh, I'll see you next week." And one day I walked into Wally Heider Recording, which was the closest one to me, and knocked on the door. And I said, hey, talk to Terry. I was like, whoa, okay. I think it was Terry. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And I went and talked to the guy and said, well, can you start now? Said, yeah, it was like, I don't know, 3:30 in the afternoon or something. I said, yeah, sure. And they took me down to a separate building, which was the big building on Sunset Boulevard, which was the RCA building. Mm-hmm. They said, we need somebody to do phones, to be on the phones here. You got to make coffee, clean the coffee.
The classic starting role.
Yeah, yeah. Kettles. Make sure the bathrooms are clean. And if somebody asks you to go get, you know, like if they need some food or something, get some money off them. There's lots of restaurants around. So I could go just get it, put the order in. They showed me how to work the phone, transfer calls, and introduced me to one other assistant there, to an actual assistant, and introduced me to the equipment room upstairs if I was needed to go get something, and said goodbye. And put me on the phones. I was there in this big building, a big, huge hallway. Like, you know, the hallway went from here to that tree. And I just looked down the hallway, and I was at a phone just sitting here.
But you were in.
I was in, man. And there were some calls. I transferred the calls, and nobody said anything about what I was doing there, who was there. And I was, you know, I was there till it must have been about midnight or something, or 11. It was late in the evening. And the front door opens, and a foot comes in, and the front door closes on the foot. and an arm comes in and tries to squeeze. You know, it's one of these self-closing hydraulic door things. Yeah. You know, squeezing body in and getting, just trying to get the door off me. Got the door on me. Put himself up against the wall with his shoulder on the wall, and then scooted with his shoulder on the wall the whole way down to me. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out $100 bill and put it on the table and said, "Get me some ribs." And it was Keith Richards. Yeah, that was it.
Did you recognize him as soon as he appeared?
Whoa! Yeah, I went, "Oh fuck," you know. And
what do you say to that?
Yeah, I said he didn't. You know, I never made eye contact with the guy there. He was just so out of it. But then he sort of stumbled his way into the studio. But and they were in there making a record that would become Emotional Rescue, which was just after Tattoo You, I think, or Some Girls, maybe. Maybe it was after Some Girls. And they'd come back to that studio because they had done their first two albums in that room.
Wow.
In Hollywood. Mm. In the early 60s.
Wow.
Yeah. And they just thought, let's go there. So yeah, that was my first night in the studio. So that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
So, I got pretty hooked on it. And it was great to see them, you know. I got to go in, take the food in, them and you know, just hang out a little bit too long. See Keith Richards where he's like, just, it looks like he can't function, but the minute it's like he gets up, he goes out and he sort of, you know, and then they put the guitar on him. He just goes
business mode.
And then he plays like nobody. Wow. He plays, and his time is just superlative. It's like the most incredible feel you've ever heard.
So that's a pretty formative experience, right? Like, you've just started at this place and you meet the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
So, I mean, after that, you're kind of like, right.
Well, it was a pretty hot studio. So the Rolling Stones were in there. Up the street in a different building in one of the little rooms was Tom Waits.
Oh, wow.
In those early days, doing like, he wasn't doing Heart Attack on Vine then, but just after that, I think. Who else came in? There's Lee Ritenour, who was a jazz guitarist. There were people coming in to do sound tracks for movies because they had a sound stage there.
Yeah.
David Bowie had a playback party for Scary Monsters there. Didn't record there, but one of my first sessions that I was on as an assistant was Peggy Lee. She came in to sing with her gold-plated 57. Sure, SM57. Brilliant. She was brilliant. So it was a big studio that people knew about, and it was a wonderful studio. Frank Sinatra had done a lot of his records there. Elvis Presley had done all his RCA records in these rooms.
Right,
so they had a history. They're like the Abbey Road
right
of,
up there,
Hollywood.
Yeah,
you know,
like, yeah.
It was a really good place to start. And I didn't know it when I hadn't followed the people who were working there. I just wanted a job in the studio.
So. So how did they let you go from, how does it work from like being the kind of get the tea and go for stuff and fix it all up and be the cool guy to, you want to just come and help me out on this desk? Or how does that work? Well, I've never quite understood that.
Well, in those days, there weren't schools for this. And in fact, they wouldn't have wanted you to, they liked training you for their studio. They had particular protocols that they wanted you to adhere to, right?
Right.
And some of them were good and others weren't so good. For me, I was, I had just gotten into my head, reading. I was really into philosophy and I loved the Stoics. And I'd just been through reading The Fountainhead. Ayn Rand, Fountainhead, and which really blew my mind. I really loved it. And what it sort of did for me was reinforce certain things that I had found out from doing some smaller jobs of, like, the bosses, you know, who would just give me little things to say, you know, tell me how to do things that really made sense once I read some of these philosophies and things about work ethics. And I just decided that it's only worth working. It doesn't matter what it is you do. It doesn't matter whether you're cleaning a toilet, washing a coffee pot, or sweeping out a room, or building, you know, a life-saving machine or whatever. It doesn't matter. As long as, you know, just, you know, be competitive with yourself. Do it the best you can on that day, and then try to beat yourself the next day, you know, like, and so I really had a bug up my ass about doing, like, 150%.
Yeah, yeah. But you had a love for that work as well, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't know what it entailed. I didn't know exactly what it entailed. I just started out, and then I was in the equipment room. But, yeah, being in the studio was exciting, and they let you use the studios when nobody was in them. So I could go in late at night after I worked. If I got off work at, say, 10, I could go in at 11 or 12 and stay till 6 in the morning. And I ended up getting turntables and vinyl, and some of my records, and I'd put them on and start to learn the console by plugging the record player in different places so I could use the equalizers and the faders and then the outboard gear, compressors, effects. I started, you know, I thought at the time, oh, man, that sounds so much better than what they did. I'd put a record on and I'd add harmonizer with delays on it and stuff. I'd go, yeah, this is happening. And then I'd make a cassette of that and have, and for me it was like, yeah, that sounds way better than they did.
Little personal remixes. The record, you know?
I was augmenting these records. And I was learning. And then there were assistants there that were really good, but a lot of them sort of, you know, they'd see the pencil holder and there was supposed to be a certain amount of paper and pencils and whether they're sharpened or not, and grease pencils for editing, fresh razor blades, and they were all there, but I'd walk into the studio to check it because I'd be the last guy to check. The assistants were supposed to do a lot of that stuff. But I'd go in and check and see that, oh, well, those three pencils have been used since they were sharpened. They're not fresh. And in my head, I thought, anybody who comes in here, it's got to be virgin studio, like nobody's ever been in here before. They got to feel like I'm in here. This is like a hotel room, you know. You don't want to go in there and find the shit in the toilet, right? So I'd freshen up the pencils, you know, and the razor blade, I'd take a razor blade out, but leave the safety wrapper on and put it next to the editing block and make sure the tape was there. And instead of the tape, I was
attention to
almost
detail.
OCD. how when you do tape and it just ends and you can't find the end?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'd peel back the end and fold it over.
Yeah.
So you'd have a tab on all the tapes, paper tapes, masking tapes, editing tape, gaffer tape, tab is right there. You just go to it. Right? And engineers were coming in and going over time and saying, oh, there it is. There's the end of the tape. Who did that? And the assistant would go, what? And you go, who did that? I don't know. And they end up saying, so it must have been after about a year, maybe a year and a half or two. I was there doing all this stuff and cleaning up and going in at night and sometimes even taking bands. A couple of engineers, one guy, Tim Boyle, he came up to me and said, what are you doing after work? I said, nothing really. He said, you can come into the studio. Hey, I'm going to be doing some jazz tonight, like some alive to disc jazz. You want to just come in and hang?
Mm.
Yeah, man. Because, I mean, I could go in and hang, but I had to get out pretty quick usually. I couldn't just stand there. But now I was being asked to come in. People started asking me just to come in. And invariably, they'd send the assistant out to get a new roll of tape. But then a microphone would be not working. I said, oh, shit, man, we got to get... And I said, I'll go look at it, you know? And I go out, change the cable, you know? And come back in going, yeah, it's working, great, thanks, Chad, you know? So, and eventually there were people asking me to be on the session. Hey, is Chad available to do the session?
Mm-hmm.
And the studio was sort of like, well, I don't know, he hasn't really done in very many sessions. And that's all right, you know? And then I was asked to do a session that was a film date. This must have been about 2 years in to me. I was a pretty slow burner, actually. about 2 years in, and I had learned from some pretty good people how to set up strings and the playback systems and keep everything so stuff didn't get tangled with a 100-piece orchestra, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
And I had come in and had about three of us set up this orchestra date for a film, like a real B film. It wasn't any big deal, but it was a film that was going to come out in Hollywood. And got everything set up. I tested out all the mics, knew everything was working, had the tape on, everything was ready to go. And I'm just standing in the room and waiting for the engineer, and Downbeat comes. And it's weird because engineers film dates, engineers aren't late, because you're fucked basically, because that orchestra's costing thousands, thousands an hour plus the studio,
yeah,
you know. And there's no engineer, and the conductor comes in, sticks his head in and says, are you ready? Not bad. That sounded bad. He didn't say it like that. He was like, are you ready? And I said, can you give me 10 minutes? Yeah. I'm going to go. We're going to go do some warm-ups and some, you know, we got a few cues to go through. Let me know when you're ready. And he went out, started just working with the orchestra. I started bringing mics up and, you know, checking the levels. And I'm pretty scared. Pretty fucking scared. Getting everything going and he looks back and is like, you know, are you ready? Start recording the cues for the film. And some other assistant had come in and said, what's going on? I said, I can't talk right now, you know. And he must have gone and told the management, hey, did you know that there's no engineer in
Chad's dude.
Chad's behind the console right now? So the manager of the company, he's quite well known in LA. He'd done a lot of studio management. Terry Stark. He's a rough guy, but he was really pretty wonderful with letting you do things. Came storming through the door, Savon, looking out into the studio and then looking over here and finding me and going, an orchestra's playing, and he's going, looking back and forth and just trying to see there's not a fire burning somewhere, right? And then he just looks at me and said, is everything okay? Because, you know, they'd be fucked if it got fucked up, you know? And I said, yeah, it's good. Everything's fine. He said, come and see me afterwards. And he left. And he sent in an assistant for me. and I thought I was in trouble, but he sat me down and just said, so, I'm ready to go. And, are you interested in doing any more? And
so you engineered the orchestra?
Yeah.
You recorded the whole thing?
Recorded the whole soundtrack. It's an 8-hour session in the studio, yeah. Yeah.
I should think he was pretty impressed by that.
Well, it's...
There's not, I mean...
I'm not sure it sounded very good. I don't know. I can't think back if I knew if it was good sounding or not. Yeah. But I had learned from a couple of guys who I had seen didn't do a lot. And they were the top scoring recordists at the time. Mm. And I really noticed that they didn't use a lot of equalization, and they kept their levels fairly modest, just in case there was some, you know. And they knew how to ride. And I can't read music, but I can follow a score. Mm-hmm. So I got a score, so I could see where things were really going to build up, and I could pull it back. So I wasn't relying on compressors.
Yeah.
Which, if somebody hit something, it could sound pretty awful if it hit the compressor badly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was wiped out that by the end of the day.
But 8-hour session.
I got through it, and I didn't get any. I don't remember getting any other recording sessions off of that. It wasn't like all of a sudden now I'm a recordist. No, I went back to assisting, but that one thing really taught me a lot. And it wasn't until I left there that I started doing more recording.
And it's like you had the ability to respond to under pressure. So they, like, that's a massive thing. A lot of people would have crumbled or just run away or been like, I can't do this.
Yeah, I think it's probably the acid.
No. The confidence thing. It's a confidence thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not. I did have a confidence. I wouldn't say it came from experience, though. It was a confidence coming from ignorance. Okay.
Right. But the willingness to kind of just go for it and see what happens.
Yeah, I was completely up for doing it. I had come off having, you know, like changing gears, giving up guitar, giving up all that stuff, and just say I'm doing something else. And I was getting into photography. Not really, but just taking pictures, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And living in Hollywood on my own, and So I guess it was so fresh and new. There I was. So yeah, the confidence of the ignorant.
But that, I mean, it sounds like that opened the door then for you to be like, okay, yeah, this is what I want to do.
Well, it led to, you know, something that's. My kids have asked me about that, and my sister had asked me about that. How did I get my drive?
Yeah. You know?
And I try to tell everybody, you know, sometimes I'm not one of those people who is driven for any particular thing. Like, whatever it is I'm doing, you know, I really do want to do it the best that I can. I'm not trying to be the best in the world.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go. When I finish something, I think I've finished it. My first question is, have I actually given it 100%? And I'm pretty good at being honest with myself and saying, you know what? I think I've only given it about 50. That was really hard, but no, okay, I got to work on this some more. And it's never mattered whether it cost me, you know, maybe I only got paid for 4 hours or something. And in 4 hours, if it wasn't done, I'd spend another 15 to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So I've always done that. And because I am, I'm slow ass, man.
I'm methodical.
I'm not one of those people who just whips stuff out. No. I mean, you know, it's like, it gets so good. I got to work it. I have to labor it to do something well. So I know that's what it takes. So maybe that's, you know, I didn't have a drive. Everything that's happened to me, I've kind of fallen into.
Mm.
But then when I've fallen into it, I've just said, well, I'm going to do this the best I can. And if it didn't work out, then I do something else.
That's a great attitude.
So I fell into engineering, just, you know, talking and, well, I'll go get a job. Didn't know if I was going to be an engineer. I got a job in a studio, really, to have free studio time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't playing in a band, so I could do my own music. But then I found I was a lousy composer. And I wasn't that great a guitar player either. Because I was now surrounded by people who were coming in that were
really good.
Fucking good.
Yeah.
And Keith Richards, you know, right? So what am I going to do? Ask him to give me a lesson? You know, by the coffee machine?
Yeah,
I should have, really.
Yeah.
I didn't have that much chutzpah. But, so I, you know, and then when people started asking me in the studio, I just did the best I could. Then when I was, you know, like the next phase was somebody asked me to come work at their little studio that they were starting out. That was a demo studio. And I went to work there and got asked to engineer some stuff. And, you know, of course, I'd work 20 hours, you know, I was only supposed to be there for 10, but no, it's not right. We gotta get this right, you know, and
that goes a long way with people, though.
Well, it goes a long way. I think it goes a long way with yourself,
yeah,
more than anything. And then you hope that people appreciate it. If they don't, it doesn't matter. I like other people appreciating stuff. I'm not, you know, devoid of.
But you're not expecting it.
Social interaction and all of that. But it's not required.
Yeah.
It's icing on the cake. If you like the people that like what you do, then that's great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what happens when there's people you don't like and they love what you do? You go, hmm. That's not what drives me.
I really like what you said before about challenging yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there seems to be something key in that. Yeah, just keep pushing, keep pushing.
It really is for me. I want to feel good about what I do. And I can really put myself through hell. I can really get depressed and horrid and really have bad days from thinking I didn't do a good job on this, you know. So I'm my harshest critic.
Yeah. So that sort of that led on to you doing your own gigs and your own kind of your own engineering, your own production stuff.
You know, I did a lot of mostly engineering. I've always been a reluctant producer.
Yeah.
But engineering was fine. And I, again, you know, I started working at other studios and, you know, just did odds and ends. And a guy came in, Mitchell Froom. He was doing a band called Crowded House, and they hated their engineer and fired him. And 10 minutes later came in and said, "Hey, would you finish recording this record with us?" Yeah, sure. And I did that and then became Mitchell Froom's engineer for 14 years.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
You know, he liked my off-the-cuff, he was very methodical into pre-production, perfect pitch, and brilliant at putting arrangements together. He can orchestrate, and he's a great keyboard player.
Right.
I don't want anything to do with that. he'd say, "So we're going to have pre-production. You want to come?" I said, "No. I don't want to be there." He might have pre-production for 2 weeks and I wouldn't come. I want to come in and hear the music and go, what do I do? What can I do?
Yeah. You know? Responding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lucky for me, he really loved it. He loved that we had this contrast because he was looking for that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I learned everything I've learned from about it. Arrangements and stuff from him.
He gave you the freedom to just do your thing, right?
Well, besides that, he did stuff like he might have ideas for these tight chord clusters or, you know, the arrangements of instruments. But I'd go, because I liked distortion and I liked feeling.
A bit of rough edges.
I like, even if it's a ballad, I want you to feel like it's a little dangerous to listen to this right now. You know, I want something in there to be, should I be listening to this? You know, I love that in music myself. Mm. So I was getting into pots and pans and trash cans in the studio and distortion, running drums through a guitar amp and pedals. And, I didn't invent it. I had seen that. At a studio that I worked at, a guy named David Leonard, and I thought I didn't really hear much what he was doing, but
that idea, yeah.
So I started doing it, and And when we started doing things on drums like that, Mitchell would go, wow, okay, so now this doesn't need all this other stuff, you know? It doesn't need those two guitar parts, or it doesn't need a pedal bass part. Now the bass can be free to do something else. Or so there's a symbiosis there between what's going on. So you can change what you need in an arrangement by your sounds.
Right? Yeah.
And we started going for more characterful sounds. So like starting with Los Lobos, not many people, I think, know Los Lobos over here, really.
But I know the name, but yeah. I've never heard any sound.
And doing some pretty wild-sounding records that started to get noticed.
Yeah. I think, for me, when I was like a teenager, I remember the first time I sort of started to notice... after the bands, you know, you buy the records and you look on the back and you read all the information, you know, recorded by so-and-so, you know, additional this by that, and then it'd be like engineered by, produced by, and I started to look at and notice that at a certain age.
Yeah.
And I started to think, oh yeah, like these guys have a key impact on what this record sounds like now. It's not just the musicians. Mm. Like you start to evolve your vision of how an album is created and recorded. Yeah. And I remember I think it was probably the first Joseph Arthur album. I remember seeing your name on the back, and there was a couple of tracks on that I loved the sound of. Invisible Hands was this, like, I remember you mixed...
Second record.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. First one I'd heard.
Yeah. And Jackie, my wife, worked on the first one.
She was
a recording engineer at Real World. She was the chief recording engineer at Real World Studios. Yeah.
We haven't even got onto Real World yet.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember that's where I first started seeing the names and seeing your name and those kind of things going into my head of like, yeah, these people, this is interesting what they're doing. I'm really kind of like taking notice of this.
Yeah.
And I think, and then the big one where I saw your name again was Binaural, the Pearl Jam record, one of my favorite Pearl Jam records. Such a good thing, and that was like kind of your vision, right? So they say.
No, I don't want to deflate your vision of the record. It was a very difficult record, but that wasn't my. It originally was something that I, and they originally wanted something quite different to what they had been doing, which I thought, great. If you want me, then that's what you're going to get. So, I'm not going to listen to your records and go, okay, what can I do?
We'll do it like it sounds. Yeah.
But. In the course, there's a lot of reasons why it was a difficult and trying record that I ended up not actually finishing. I mean, I guess I did finish some of it, but there were health problems, big ones, not simple health problems, big health problems, relationship problems. The new drummer had just had a baby, and we didn't really get on. I liked drummers to be a bit sloppy and drunken, and he was just like a machine,
tight.
And I kept asking him, can you play a little...
Just loosen up a bit.
I am, you know. He's still... I won't go.
He's a big guy.
He's a big guy. And plus, he just had a baby. He just wanted to get home. I think they ended up using maybe half my mixes.
Ah, okay.
Then the other half were remixed. I still recorded them.
You did all the...
Produced But Brendan O'Brien came in and mixed some in the end. By the mix time, I felt my hands were tied. I wasn't enjoying the mixing.
Okay.
Anymore. If I could mix it now.
Yeah.
So it ended up, they didn't entirely want what I had to offer. It still came out a different record for them. It's real different.
The sound is distinctive compared to their last.
So I'm happy about that. I'm still proud that I got to maybe inch my way into there and help them make a change that they wanted to make.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as radical as I had envisioned.
And was this around the time that you came to the UK, or was this?
Just before. In fact, Jackie used to come visit me in Seattle. We were courting then, yeah.
Oh, how did you guys meet then? Through the industry somehow?
I met her in the 90s. I was mid to late 90s. I had I'd engineered a record, one of T-Bone Burnett's. I used to work for T-Bone a lot, and T-Bone Burnett's solo records. And he had gotten a guy named David Rhodes to produce it. And I wasn't sure who David Rhodes was then. And I should have known because I'm a big Peter Gabriel fan. And that was Peter Gabriel's guitar player who had been with him for, you know, decades.
Okay.
And so I met David, and we hit it off. And so the next time I came over to the UK, we ended up going and visiting and meeting Peter. And it was around the time of Passion of Christ, I think he was doing that soundtrack. So I remember we were looking at all the artwork around the dinner table with him, with Peter. And so I started going to Real World, and I worked there a few times. And once when I worked there, I was told that, I think it was, Nigel Kennedy was in there doing an electric, he was like a Hendrixy. He was
the violin dude.
And they needed some outboard gear, and the engineer that was doing it had said that I had some that would really work well. So they came in, and Jackie was also, had been with Nigel. They were a couple for 3 or 4 years or something. And she recorded all his life. She recorded a bunch of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Of some of his records. And so she came in. I think that would have been the first time I would have seen her. And later, must have been a year later, they had split up. And she came back to Real World to get a job. And she got the job. So, and I wasn't there yet. I was just coming back and forth. And we met at some point in those times when I came back for the world weeks that we had, recording weeks we'd have, or a record that I was doing.
I needed your input.
And she'd be there. She'd end up being my assistant.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great.
So that's how we met.
Yeah. And you ended up then eventually working at Real World.
Well, when we'd go back to the States when we decided to make it, you know, to get married, then we stayed in L.A. She came to L.A. And we did a few records there. I can't remember what we were doing, like a Bonnie Raitt record or something, and might have been another Joseph Arthur album at that time. And it was right at the time I was just on the, you know, had done the Sheryl Crow record and the Globe Sessions, and those are my first two really big successes. So it was a good time, and Jackie got pregnant, and we hadn't planned it. It wasn't something that we were trying to do, but when she got pregnant, we just both went, yes, why not? This would be great, wouldn't it? And I remember us being really happy about it. And then I just said, not in L.A.
Mm.
I don't want to bring up a kid here. So we packed up and moved to near Castle Coombe, down in Wiltshire, 10 minutes from Real World.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I guess then you're going to be knocking on the door sometimes, like,
what?
Hey, need anything? Need a...
No, Real World, I was already in.
You're already in.
Yeah, when I got there, it was like Peter was... He already had 3 gigs for me.
Oh, he was probably pretty happy about
being
there.
Yeah, and then he was going to start doing Up. Which he had been working on for 8 years or something, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a bunch of stuff. There was Ovo, there was Big Blue Ball. There was all these records that came up. And there was more Joseph Arthur. And there was other Real World stuff. And then there was people coming for me. I produced a couple of jazz albums, The Bad Plus.
Oh, yeah.
And they
came
over to record there. And guy from Powderfinger, Australia, Bernard Fanning. I can't even remember all the stuff they ended up doing there. But spent, 7 or 8 years in that room.
Wow. Yeah. Which was that the longest stint that you'd been in one kind of
no
studio?
Sound Factory with Mitchell. 14 years in the same place.
That was the same studio.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, we were in the same. It was our room.
Wow.
It became our room pretty much.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What's some of your, if you had to pick, I don't know if you can pick, but what are some of your favorite kind of records that you've been involved in?
It's too hard. You know, I have so many records that I really like that I, and, you know, I forget about that I've worked on them. I just like the songs and the personality of the artist, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes when I hear them, I do, like, especially on iPods, it's funny, you know, it's going to sound... You know, I don't mean to sound, it's not arrogant, it's not the word, but I'm not trying to sound weird here, but the stuff will come on in the car from an iPod or something. I'll go, oh shit, what year was this? This was a big hit. And it's so good. And wow, this is the sound of that. And then, you know, 3 seconds in, you know, I'll clock it and go, oh shit, this is, you know, this is soul coughing, you know, and I did it, and I'm loving it, you know. I think I've been really fortunate to work on probably 90% of the stuff I've done. I've loved.
Yeah.
Doing.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I really, really like a lot of it. So
yeah.
I find it really hard to sit and give you, you know. I had to listen to the first Ron Sexsmith record I worked on with Mitchell the other day. And of course, while I'm listening to it, I'm going, this is one of my favorite records. The songs are amazing.
Yeah.
And it's odd sounding. It doesn't sound like just a singer-songwriter. It sounds like there's some funny percussion and weird guitar sounds. And then I'll hear a Stina Nordenstam and go, oh my gosh, I love these records. Lisa Germano. I think maybe, Lisa Germano always
Which
comes
Stina
out.
Did you work on?
Two.
Work on the first one?
Oh, no. This is later. She's done so many records.
Because she had a big break, didn't she? She didn't really do anything for a long time.
You know, and she's...
I remember that first one, though.
That would have been back in the 90s, early 90s or something, right?
Yeah.
No, Mitchell and I did one together called This is Stina Nordenstam. That would have been late 90s.
Yeah.
It's a great record. This is beyond great. That should have been a hit record, you know. In my world, that would have been a hit record. Lisa Germano's Slide, which I got to play on it with her and produce it and engineer it. And that's a pretty strong record. Beautiful, but it's the songwriting that kills me. But I think that got framed really nicely. I love the soul coughing records, Latin Playboys stuff. There's too much. Black Keys, I love the Black Keys.
I'm a
Black Keys freak.
How did it feel? How did you feel about awards and Grammys and things like that? Did that kind of? I guess you're just like, it's great.
PR.
Someone likes it, but
it's PR.
Yeah,
you know. That's all it is. It's the way the voting system is, there's no confidence in anything, it being meaningful in any way.
Okay. Like so many awards.
So the only way it's meaningful, which is kind of weird, but I've grown to sort of go accept it. It's meaningful for people who aren't in the business to look at that and go, oh my gosh, you've got one of those, you know. And I've stopped a long time ago trying to say, you know...
It's not all that.
It's just a PR thing. They just try to sell in more records and trying to make more money for the music. But, you know, stop doing that.
Does it help in any way in a professional sense where, like, someone goes, oh, hey, that guy, I remember, he won the Grammy.
No, it can actually do the opposite.
Can it?
Because they think you're priced out of their range. So, people you might want to work with. I've seen that happen twice.
Okay.
I've seen two engineers win Grammys who were great engineers, and they won Grammys, and they didn't work after that.
Wow. Yeah.
So, it's not all it's cracked up to be. But like anything else, you know, we all like accolades. And, you know, at first blush, you go, oh, that feels good, you know. And then if you think about it some more, you go, well...
Actually, it's bullshit as well.
But you still like it. It's better than a kick in the head.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a bit of a double-edged
thing. I don't know, maybe those kind of things open other doors that weren't open before and opportunities, I don't know.
I don't think it does I don't know anybody who's hired anybody because they won a Grammy.
Yeah.
I don't know one person. Now, if you won enough Grammys in production and maybe engineering, you might, like when you retired, get a job as an A&R guy at a label. I don't know. Maybe that would help. I've got a shelf full of Grammys.
It's on my CV.
Maybe.
Yeah, but not really.
You know, I don't think anybody has ever gone, even the guy who has the most Grammys in the world, Al Schmidt, you know, people don't go, well, he's got Grammys, let's hire him. They hire him because he's fucking good.
Yeah.
You know, nobody can do what he does.
Yeah.
So that's why he gets hired.
And that's why you get hired as well.
That's why we all get hired. Yeah. People want, like, what necessarily do. What they want, what, well, you hope they want what we do. Everybody has their own ears. It's a personal thing.
Yeah. And what are you working on at the moment? What's kind of like getting you going at the moment?
I'm on the tail end of a couple of Chrissy Hynde projects.
Oh yeah.
One's just a, you know, I don't even know what's gonna happen with it. Odd songs that are beautiful. But we're also as a family, we've been doing videos. She's been doing this thing called the Dylan Lockdown series. That goes on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook. She just wanted to cover Dylan songs. And one day she said, hey, Stan does videos. I've known her
long back.
We go back 30 years. And so she knows what the boys are into and Jackie and everybody. And Stan's still doing videos? Yeah. Can you guys make a video for this song? Okay. Yeah, see what we can do. And we ended up really getting into it. And we did I've
seen this on your Instagram. It's the one shot here with the...
All in one-er.
And then lots of moving around. Yeah, the one shot.
He did it. It's all in one shot.
Oh, man, it's so good.
We staged it, set it up, ran through it twice.
It looked like so much fun, and, kind of prepping that. Like,
yeah, it was really a lot of fun. Changing hats, you know, and putting a shirt on. And so we did that. And she said, I wasn't expecting that. It's incredible. Do you want to do another one? And that'll be it. We'll get somebody else to do some other videos because she wanted to keep going, doing like 10 or 15 Dylan songs.
Ah, right.
But then after the third one, she said, I don't want to break up this team. This is a revelation. This is lovely. You got to do the next one. You know? So we're now doing the ninth one right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And there will be 10. We're capping it at 10.
Yeah.
So we've got this one, which is different. This is going to be like a bit of a homage to Steve Bing, who is a big friend of lots of people in the music business. So we're not sure what we're doing with it yet, but she's given us some ideas. Chrissy's and Jackie's got some ideas too. So in fact, we got to shoot some of that tonight. And I'm doing some work for a guy named Tom Gallo. Doesn't have a label, puts his albums out with whoever he can. He's amazing.
Tom Gallo. What's his vibe?
Sorry?
What's his vibe? Like, is he solo?
He was like, he was just learning when I did his first record, guitar and percussion. And he sings sort of like early, like middle Pink Floyd, where... really almost conversational, soft, melodic, with, it's almost like a naive painting. And I just find it brilliant. So I'm doing a second album for him. Doing some Nick Harper stuff.
Oh, cool.
Just finished a Black Keys blues album. It's the guys, but with two other guys. I'm not gonna say any more about it than that. With two blues fellas from the South. And what else have I done? Oh, I'm just starting up some. They don't know. Nobody really knows her over here, Ani DeFranco.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Starting up a record with her. I did a record with her over the summer, which I love to mention because it needs mentioning. For the U.S., it's called the Prison Project. And she and a friend of hers worked with inmates, writing, arranging, and recording songs. And in fact, I remember one of the songs was a kind of a rap song, and I couldn't quite understand the words. So I called her up and said, "Look, can you send me the original file? Because you guys have affected this, you know, like to make it sound like it's in a telephone, and I love it, the effect, but there's noise there that, and I'm not able to understand all the words, and I've tried to draw it out." And she said, "That's it, man. He did it from jail.
Down the phone.
He did it on the phone." And I started listening, and you can hear in the background, you can hear cell block 14 closing, so you hear stuff going on.
Great idea for a project.
Yeah, so there are vocals on there from prison. And it's a great project, and it's all the money's going to go towards helping make more awareness of the prison situation in America, which is probably close to what it is all over the world in some ways, the privatization of the prison system, which has been just horrific. So that was one project. It's a beautiful record. Some really good music.
I'll check that out. That sounds great. Yeah.
It's on Righteous Babe Records.
Righteous Babe. Is that her label?
That's her label.
It sounds like it.
And there's a companion book, which is quite good, too.
Amazing.
Of poetry by two of the people that were involved in writing.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah.
So you're not short of things to do then, eh?
There is plenty. It's hard. It's a little thin at the moment.
Yeah, how have you found the whole lockdown thing? Is that
well because of where we live, nothing's really changed for us, and our boys were homeschooled. We've been together 24/7 for 18 years.
Yeah,
it's only changing now because Buck's going; he's going to uni.
Oh, cool!
And my youngest is going to college, so nothing. The only thing that's weird is going shopping,
Yeah.
But work has thinned out because I do work that has been done, so all the stuff that was recorded before lockdowns hit, I've kind of just finished up.
Yeah.
Luckily, stuff like Nick Harper, he does it. He just does his own stuff at a home studio. Tom Gallo does the same.
Yeah.
But those aren't projects that are, those are like family projects. They don't pay anything. Ani, she also has her own tight bubble of people to do recordings, and then she has people do recordings and send them to her. So I think, and she's just starting up now, so I'm only starting.
Okay.
I've got couple of songs to do, but she'll send them as they finish them. So it's not like normal because I can have two or three projects going at once. I don't have that.
Yeah.
I mean, actual full-on work paying projects.
Yeah,
But I haven't had that for 2.5 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's different.
Yeah. 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 What do you do when you're, what do you do to relax?
I love photography.
Yeah.
And, we've got plenty to do around here, things that need...
Keep you busy.
We've got horses to take care of. We've got those two sheep. They don't take much, but... there's things to do around here.
Yeah, yeah.
I love reading. Photography is probably the big one. And I've gotten to go out and, take pictures of things, like Mid Palace Youth Theater. They let me come take pictures.
Oh, cool.
Of all the plays, and I've even made a couple of books. I mean, my own, they're too expensive to produce, but the Willow Globe, Shakespeare Link, where they put on the Shakespeare plays. I'm there almost every play to take pictures.
Oh, brilliant.
And they let me do that, and I get to practice my photography, and I just give them the pictures, you know. I think with those, I'm getting to be a much better photographer practicing like that. You know, when there's stuff going on, you know, like the Black Lives Matter, like a lot of the kids have organized Black Lives Matter and for Landot and Bilth. I get to go and take pictures of them. I almost like it. Well, I do. I like it equally to doing the day job.
Yeah. I guess it's a different thing, isn't it, when you're just being creative for yourself and you're just kind of experimenting more, I guess. Yeah.
I have branched out. I composed music for a play for Impelo. They did a play, unfortunately, got shelved while... But there was a science, not a play, a dance. And it was brilliant. They brought in people from the Royal College. We had a week of R&D to find out what cells would, you know, how cells react and if they make sound and what kind of vibrations they make. And I had to research some sonocytology, which is about the sounds that cells make.
Wow.
Because they wanted me to do the music for the dance. And it was going to be aimed at kids like 7 to 12 or something.
Right.
And it's an interactive dance. And they got Steve Messam, who's a brilliant environmental artist up north, to do the set. And we did it. We did this whole thing. We got sponsorship from Bose for the sound system.
Wow.
And we had it all set up, ready to go.
Is it rescheduled? Or
I hope so. I hope they. The thing is that the dancers they had, everybody was rehearsed and it was a well-oiled machine, you know, ready to go. And I think they've already lost 2 dancers to other things now. And
did you even get to do like a full rehearsal?
There was one kind of show for kids down at the dance center in Landot.
Yeah.
I think they did. They went and performed it at the Imperial College. So they did get a couple of shows in. And I hope it gets back up. But I love doing that. So that I can do that in my free time now.
I like
playing, you know, making little bits of music that's only for me. And in this case, I got to put it in a dance.
So yeah, and I bet they loved it.
I loved it. Yeah. Really fun.
Awesome, man. Listen, thank you so much for your time today. I feel like I need to wrap it up now. We've been nattering for ages.
Yeah, well, sorry. I go on, man. You got to stop me.
I'm doing it.
Yeah, you open up the floodgates on things. I'm happy to talk about this shit.
Oh, I love it. It's fascinating meeting you and hearing about all this stuff and seeing the evolution of this person who was just a name on a CD for me as a kid. And it's like... It's really interesting, and I'm really grateful for your time, so thank you.
Thanks for asking. We found our way.